Hello and welcome to The Confession Box. I'm your host, Wendy Grace. Coming up on today's podcast, for years we've been told that overpopulation is the issue we need to be fearful of. Yet, when you look at the data, this doesn't stack up. The opposite is true. My guest today is a data scientist and demographer who, through his documentary Birth Gap, is exploring falling birth rates, unplanned childlessness, and population decline around the globe. Has any country managed to successfully reverse this trend? And what happens if we don't do anything about it? That's all coming up on today's Confession Box. So Stephen, it is great to have you with us today. I know that as part of your research, you looked at 24 countries. Now, at the beginning, it seemed to me that your question was probably what a lot of us would think, is that perhaps the reason for population decline is that culturally things have changed and people are choosing to have smaller families. But it was very interesting because your research actually revealed and told a very different story. Maybe start off telling us a little bit about that.
Yes, and this was actually stunning to me because it was really a year and a half into my own research, I realized that there was something wrong within the data. We have this tendency to look at the overall average children per woman, but of course, we know there's no such thing as an average woman, but yet in statistics, we keep talking about the average woman. No, what's happened is that motherhood has been robust for decades. The number of children that mothers are having really hasn't changed. Going back, in some cases, to the 70s, what has happened to really mask all this is an explosion in childlessness, most of which is unplanned.
So is this more of a situation of, is it a cultural change where women are thinking of starting families later, or people are generally just coupling up later, settling down later, and maybe not, is it that we're not realizing our biological clock is sadly something that exists?
Well, that starts to touch at it, but there are more nuances. Of course, this is men and women. We've got so much data on women that we tend to talk about women, but of course, this is everyone. And no one has been telling us, you know, we're all very good as societies and as parents, telling people to get a good education, study hard, train hard, and then get established in the workforce. And that's entirely natural. People want to do that. But when you look at the outcome, and it's not only biology, but for all of the countries I researched, when a woman reaches 30, if she is not already a mother, at most she only has a 50% chance of ever becoming a mother. And usually that's because of not having a partner or not having a partner who's on the right page at that same moment in time. Biology then kicks in too. So after 30, it appears that it just gets harder and harder. And as I say, that's led to this boom in unplanned childlessness.
That is probably one of the statistics that shocked me the most. As you said, Stephen, you know, a woman who hasn't had a baby by the time they're 30, they've only a 50% chance. And I think a lot of women listening, if they're in and around that age nowadays, feel, oh, I'm still very young. I got married when I was 27 and everybody kind of thought, well, you're so young. I was 30 having my first baby. I was certainly one of the first among my peers. Yet this was very different for my mother and, of course, her mother before her, that there's been a big change in a short space of time in terms of when we might think about having children. But it's interesting, as you're looking at so many different countries, did you find that this was the case across different cultures as well?
Yes. I mean, this is the point that really I sought out to find a common reason. It didn't make sense that what's happening in Japan and South Korea could be very different to what's happening in Italy and Germany and Spain and the UK, Ireland too, US, etc. To me, that would be like saying that, you know, some epidemic that started in a place and spread around the world, you know, was actually all independent, epidemics and all connected. It was obvious there was a connection, and the connection is this delayed parenthood. And we see as nations started to, in their own way, but often in the 70s, drift towards having children a little bit later, exactly the same moment we get this unplanned childlessness. So if you account for this, it explains really everything we're seeing in terms of the low trend towards, you know, ultra low fertility around the world.
Maybe just give us the definition or the explainer, because the documentary is called Birth Gap. So what is the birth gap?
So people might wonder, For instance, do we have too many people in the world, or what's the right number of people in the world? The actual numbers here don't really matter, certainly quite so much as the gap between the number of older people that societies have to support and the shrinking number of workers that there will be, already is in many instances. It's that gap between the old and the young that really societies are going to have to adjust to very rapidly, and that's going to be a very painful adjustment for old and young alike.
What sort of an impact do you think that will have? And maybe people aren't really joining the dots here of a world where playgrounds are empty, but nursing homes are full.
Yes, and I think it's quite easy, natural to, in some ways, assume that our communities, towns, villages, countries will shrink naturally. It doesn't work like that. What happens is you get a patchwork quilt of vacant homes that are on streets that still need to be maintained, infrastructure that still needs to be paid for, buses and trains and bridges, etc., that need to be maintained. And of course, health systems. And the health systems that we all have it need to cater to both old and young. And there's a certain balance today. Frankly, there already are a lot more older people who need health care than young, and we're able to support that in most of our societies. But that shift towards older people is going to become more and more rapid. So you're really going to have these decaying communities with services that can't be supported, taxes that are going to have to increase to try and support it. And ultimately, I'll share with you, my view is that we're going to become quite nomadic societies. We're going to see emigrations in a way we haven't seen for many decades or indeed centuries, of younger people who just don't want to be labored with the quality of life that they're offered, and will go somewhere else. So I think it's going to change societies in a way that we're not even thinking about at the moment.
It's interesting, Stephen, that you mention emigration because some people might say, well, when we look at migration in general here in Ireland, similar to many other European countries, there's a big increase in immigration for a myriad of factors, but that would have an impact perhaps on boosting that magic replacement rate number. What about that argument?
Some countries may benefit from that for a time, but it's not a long-term solution. You've got several things going against you here, but we have to understand that the same trend is happening, for example, in India. The birth rate in India is already below that magical average that we call replacement level, around 2 children per woman. Parts of India are already down to levels of 1.3, 1.4, like Japan and Italy. There will not be enough immigrants in the world in a few decades to fill those spaces. But also, when you take someone from one of those countries, you're actually creating a void where they came from. You're leaving parents there with no one to, look after them hands-on, and communities that are going to be similarly, facing the same crisis. So the idea that, oh, and I'll say one more thing, the idea that immigrants are going to want to choose to come to the countries as we see them today. If your country, say a random European country, is in a state of long-term decay, will immigrants really want to shift their life, bet their future on your country? So immigration is really very frankly short-sighted, in terms of it being any form of solution to this.
Well, I can't help but think of short-sightedness, Stephen, when governments can look at the data too and see what's coming down the tracks. Yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of kind of proactive policies in place to actually try and counter this. And I have to admit, I, like you, when I've talked about this issue before, assumed, oh, people are having less children and we need to do more to support people who want to have more children, or, say that they would have more children if they could afford it. But it seems a lot of the work is actually kind of educating, a generation on if you want to have children, well, this is the kind of way you need to kind of prioritize maybe your life goals.
Well, that's right. And, we don't need to lecture people, and we need to accept and embrace people who decide that they do not want children. That's really important for any society, because it's not everyone, but surveys show that somewhere between 90 and 95% of women in their fertile years either have or want children. It's the vast majority, and I don't think people talk about that side of it enough. We also know from the data that, yes, mothers are incredibly resilient, but they're not going to be forced into having more children. You know, it's very clear, you know, through all sorts of changes over the recent decades, mothers keep having pretty much the same number of children. So it is about educating and increasing awareness for those younger people, and then having policies to support that. There are many policies around the world that we can look to, and we can see from, frankly, almost all of them that they have not worked. You know, paying people, putting money in people's pockets to have children does not work. Building more kindergartens does not work. Even shortening working hours does not work. We have so much evidence from around the world to see this. All of those things, of course, may be wonderful things for social reasons, but they cannot be assumed in any way to actually change the birth rate. I just hope that awareness of the issue amongst younger people who know that they want children, but perhaps haven't been thinking too much yet about when that might happen. I think that's the only solution we've got.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember interviewing a Hungarian minister of when they were talking about all their kind of family-friendly policies. And I know some people would point to Hungary, things like, you know, low-cost loans on houses. And I think there was, you know, money if you needed a seven-seater car. And yeah, when you actually drill down into it, I would think, yeah, that's great, but it probably wouldn't change my family planning decisions. I'd be delighted to have those things and I would take them all. But would it actually change my kind of long-term plan? I'm not quite so sure. So probably a lot of people fall into that category. But it's interesting because you're talking about, Stephen, okay, there's a whole, you know, cohort of people who say, when I was doing out my kind of life plan, children was there. That was part of it, you know, along with many other things, of course. And then you have, you know, many, many people who fall into that who then have this kind of unplanned childlessness. And I know you talked to a lot of women who had this experience as part of the documentary. What sort of stories were they telling you as to how they kind of ended up experiencing this in the first place?
Yeah, women and men. And I didn't expect this when I started out. I was coming at this project to, you know, fill my research, talking to people in their homes. The data itself didn't, you know, tell me enough about what might be actually happening. So I wanted to go to people's homes in all these countries. And once I realized it was an explosion in childlessness, that it was a connection, I was kind of brave enough to ask some women, latterly men too, in their 40s and 50s, who had wanted children, you know, what happened. And the most amazing thing was that they actually wanted to talk about this. And in many cases, I think I was the first person they had ever talked to about formerly having, you know, assumed probably that they are hoped at least that they would become mothers and fathers. And you see in the documentary the tears that were shed. You know, since the documentary, many, many more people have, you know, clearly seen it, but also, you know, shared their feelings with me. I've been aware, and I'll call out to anybody on listening to this. There are support groups. Gateway Women is certainly a great one. I'd recommend, but there are others too. This is a really difficult thing to go through, and people who did plan to have children refer to it as grief. A form of grief for the family that they once wanted but will never have. So this is not some small, you know, desire that, you know, people can oftentimes easily get over and replace with something else. That takes a lot of time.
Is there
Yeah,
things
it's
that
grief.
those who you spoke to and just looking at that analysis, Stephen, that what could have changed that trajectory? Is it education? Is it kind of cultural pressure we're put under to? You have to, you know, achieve a certain milestones in your career, or even, you know, here in Ireland, certainly it's a big thing. You have to have your own house yet. You know, my parents and grandparents certainly didn't have that, and there's always the joke told about, you know, oh, we were sitting on orange crates, we didn't have any furniture, and people just kind of got on with it. They didn't feel they had to have certain things that really we don't have until a later and later stage in life. What are the answers here?
Yeah, I think we've got to be careful though. It is very difficult, and I agree with you. You know, it's certainly there's no linkage between wealth and children. In fact, it's the inverse. You know, it's not a case if people are wealthier, by definition, they're going to have more children. What ha tends to happen is people delay parenthood even longer because they want to take more vacations and, you know, do things that they feel that they maybe can't do once they become parents. You know, the only thing we can do is let people know that there is that risk, that 50-50% risk, and then let people make up their own minds. I'm hopeful. I mean, barely a week goes by now without me getting some photograph of a new baby that's been born or someone who's now pregnant after watching the documentary, which is just, you know, so heartwarming. And, you know, I equally, there've been people who have told me, no, I watched the documentary and I'm even more sure than ever that I do not want children. It allowed me to kind of test that, you know, and these are people who just got no internal kind of instinct from watching the people who kind of lived their life without children. So, you know, it's all about awareness rather than policies. I think it's going to find ways to make housing more accessible to people in many of these countries, but that in itself won't lead to more children.
One of the things that I found fascinating was when you were going to give a talk at Cambridge University, for some reason, was controversial. And it seems whenever we talk about fertility, pregnancy, babies, all this sort of stuff, that there's a certain kind of, I guess, type of feminist that feels that this is somehow, you know, forcing this kind of pro-natalist approach on women. Tell us a little bit more about that and how you responded to it, Stephen.
Yeah, I've been called both a feminist and an anti-feminist in the same week. And I do support, of course, women's opportunities. I have a daughter who's at college right now, and you know, I want her to succeed as much in life as my two sons. So we're not going back to days of old where we're going to kind of, you know, in some way deny education or opportunities to women. We're beyond that. It's really hard right now because as societies, we're telling people to, yep, study really hard. We're making it very competitive for people to study really hard. We're saying study harder than others and do better than others because to get on that career path, the best one possible, you've got to have the best qualification possible. And then once you get in the career path, well, you can't stop. You've invested quite a few years to get to that point. And you know, especially as a woman, now there's a vulnerability. The moment you step off that ladder, even for a maternity leave for a few months, there's a vulnerability there that someone else might get the promotion or someone might kind of assume that you're not going to have time in your hands. So we don't make it easy on young mothers. We absolutely don't. So I think a difference is the intensity of career paths now is so much more than it was in the past. And part of the solution from society, I think, is opening up those opportunities. For example, why don't we have hiring rounds for young mothers aged 32, first time hiring? And by the time they're 35 or 40, they'll probably be, you know, in higher positions than they might have been otherwise. Because one thing about mothers is that they're incredibly time efficient. So, you know, I think more broadly, society really just has to enable people to have the children they want to have at the age they want to have them in a way that I think we're not doing a good job at right now.
I think there is a certain group of women who might feel kind of there's been, I don't want to say a lot, but there's been certain cultural pressure on them to not say, I want to be a mom or I want to prioritize this. And then maybe kind of peddled false hope, you know, this kind of narrative, it's okay, work on your career, freeze your eggs, it'll be grand, which has low success rates and all those sorts of things. And we're kind of sold one dream that mightn't actually be achievable. You mentioned, Stephen, you like me, you have a daughter. We're actually the same. I have a daughter and two sons. There is going to be a knock-on effect for our children of this population collapse. What will the world look like for them if we don't make some changes here?
And this is why I made the documentary. It was for my children, and they're now in their 20s. But whilst they were teens, you know, I as a parent was, you know, doing what we all do, you know, trying to give my children the best education possible and preparing them for the world as it was. And what I realized is, oh my gosh, the entire world in terms of how it functions is going to transform dramatically. And I haven't done a great job at all in preparing my kids for this new future. You know, we can take different examples, but you know, let's say, you know, I'm sure there's many people dreaming of a career in teaching, and that's great. But unfortunately, the number of teaching jobs that's going to shrink dramatically, and universities and college places. You can extend that to multiple things. Yeah, someone asked me once what words are going to be growth in terms of jobs. Well, demolition companies, I think, that's one area. I saw that in Detroit, Michigan, where their population shrank for different reasons over many decades, and the demolition companies did quite well. Now we're talking of preparing for a world where there's going to be less stability between nations, because there's going to be more and more pressures on the economies. The level of healthcare services, pensions, all the systems that many of our nations have enjoyed giving our people, those are going to be under increasing stress year by year by year while taxes go up. So I think, to go back to my point about emigration, that's one of my biggest fears, is that there will be certain hotspots within countries. I call them magnet towns, and then magnet countries where younger people flock to. And these will be areas where there is some vibrancy, where the cool new jobs are happening. But those are going to be expensive places, and older people are going to be left behind in communities that are at increasing risk of decay, because younger people are being pulled towards these more dynamic places. And then I worry about entire countries. I was in South Korea speaking last week at two events, and I talking to young Koreans there, many of them said that they and their friends are contemplating leaving the country. The birth rate there, by the way, is now coming down to something like 0.6 children per woman. So you look at South Korea, and I live in Japan, which is very close. This whole area, in terms of stability between nations, given the kind of the nations that are in surrounding Japan and South Korea, you look at a world that, frankly, is going to get scarier.
Is there any country that you looked at, Stephen, that's bucking the trend? I know sub-Saharan Africa is probably an area where the birth rate is above replacement level. What is different culturally, and is there anything we can learn from there?
Yes, so I'm glad you brought that up. So sub-Saharan Africa is indeed, above replacement level, but it's coming down quickly. Women in sub-Saharan Africa are having around 4.4 children on average, but it was something like seven a few decades ago. It's coming down by one fewer child every 15 years. So it's on the same path. They're just a few decades behind the rest of us. That said, if I were a younger person today, I'd be seriously thinking of moving to Africa. It is going to be a pace of growth, and I think there'll be some nations, some cities in Africa that will be very exciting places to be compared to what's happening, what are going to happen in the rest of the world.
Do you think that the narrative that I started off chatting to you about, Stephen, of the world is full, the world is overpopulated, obviously there's a huge amount of discussion about, the impact of our actions on the climate. Are people accepting the data as you've been presenting it in various different forums that actually, no, the data is telling a different story and we need to really take heed of it?
I was speaking at a sustainability conference in Japan a couple of months ago, and it was very rare for someone who specializes in population decline to talk at a sustainability conference. So I was looking forward to that particular opportunity. And what they found was actually warming. I'd say 80% of the people there were surprised, but wanted to engage in constructive conversation. I think most had smiles on their faces in some capacity that, okay, the world's population is actually going to peak imminently, and number of births per year is already falling, so anybody open-minded. But there was a small core at that conference who did not want to talk about this because it didn't suit their message. And there are a lot of antinatalists out there, more than I ever imagined. I encounter them a lot. They don't like what I'm doing. They want to keep this a big secret that the world's population is peaking and due to fall, because they keep wanting to spread this myth that we're still growing and there's too many people. Well, that's a myth from the past, and we need to wake up and deal with the reality of what we're facing right now, which is a rapid population decline. And this is a Sorry, let me say that again. This is a crisis the planet has never been. This is a crisis that we don't have any examples of a country that's successfully come out of before. So we need to take this one very, very seriously.
When you put it that way, Stephen, when you're saying just it's so unprecedented, I mean, do we shrug our shoulders in apathy? We've got local and European elections here in Ireland coming up very shortly. It's hard to kind of put your finger on what should I be lobbying my government representatives for, number one. And number two, what advice should I be giving my children in terms of how they plan their lives out without wanting to be kind of an overbearing parent?
I know. In some ways, though, one of the nicest comments I received about the documentary was a family watched it with their teenagers. And after, it was the first time the teenagers had ever talked about their future desires for family and education. And they were able as a family to have a conversation about it. So maybe some advice would be, you know, part one's out now on YouTube. It's available for free. Educators around the world will have access to all three parts for free. I've committed to that. In terms of politicians, I have been able to talk to quite a few politicians, including former leaders of a number of European and countries around the world over the past year. They want to talk about this. They don't understand it. And once they start to understand the gravity of it, you can see the seriousness with which they start to take. I think encouraging politicians to simply talk about this more, you know, in their communities, in their constituencies, in their parliaments is vital. That just has not been happening up until now.
Is there also a role that kind of big business has to play? Because like I kind of touched on earlier, I find it interesting to see really big companies doing things like, you know, supporting egg freezing or fertility treatments and all those sorts of things. But is there something to be said for policies that say, do you know what, if you decide that what is for you in your life to have, you know, a baby earlier than, you know, like I think here in Ireland, if the average age of a first time mum has changed dramatically in the last kind of 15 years, it's 31, you know, that those sorts of things could also have an impact as well, that this policies and different kind of supports in place that say, look, it's not going to impact your trajectory. In fact, we'll think of ways to make sure that it doesn't.
One of the things I'm calling for through my nonprofit is to encourage employers to actually release information so that younger people can make the right decision as to which employer is best for them. Information like what's the average age that someone working for company A has a child versus company B? What's the rate of childlessness in each company? I think young people should be able to choose companies that better suit what they're looking for in life. And if there's a given company where the average age is 35 and another the average age is 28, that might help some people make decisions. And the really smart companies are actually going to start to do this, because in nations where we have shrinking numbers of available young people, which is going to be basically almost everywhere, those employers who do align more closely with the desires of young people for family will be the ones who get the best workers, who retain the best workers. And I think from there, you know, the corporate world as a whole will have to shift and move behind this concept of truly supporting younger people, not just giving somebody nominal maternity or paternity leave. So yeah, the corporate world has a lot to do to help themselves actually, as well as societies.
Just finally to ask you, Stephen, you know, if you have the ear of kind of the most influential politician or presidents of different countries, what's the one thing you'd say to them? Look, if you can do one thing to try and counter this birth gap, this is what it would be.
Talk about fertility windows in high schools. We tell young people how to avoid unwanted pregnancies. In those same lessons, we should also be sharing the data, for example, that only half of women beyond 30 end up becoming mothers. I think if younger people knew that, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Well, Stephen J. Shaw, thanks so much for joining us on the Confession Box podcast. As Stephen mentioned earlier, you can watch part one of the Birth Gap documentary. It's free to watch on YouTube. Stephen, it's been great to have you with us today, and it's been great to have you as well. I've been your host, Wendy Grace. If you could like and subscribe on your favourite platform, that'd be fantastic. I'll talk to you soon.